From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson, and in our final hour of this summer book week for this year, our connection is the incredibly important one between young readers and the world of books. Joining us for this pre-recorded hour are two of Rochester's most prominent figures in children's literature. Charles Benoit is a former teacher, an ad man, a ska musician, and the author of four young adult novels, including this year's Snow Job. Linda Sue Park has lived all over the world and has turned her experiences into a long list of books for both the youngest readers and young adults. Her latest include Yak's Yak, Animal Word Pairs, and Wing and Claw, Forest of Wonders, which is the first part of a trilogy. Linda Sue Park, Charles Benoit, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Great to have you here. Let's start, before we get into the specifics of your new books, let's start by talking a little bit just about children's literature in general. And I come at this, as Charles knows, a little bit biased by having two kids who fortunately have grown up to be avid readers. My daughter just finished seventh grade. My son just finished second grade. And I delight in seeing them engage in books and with books. What's it like to know that you have that kind of responsibility to help shaping and helping to shape what kids are reading?
It's the best job in the world. It's so important that young people that from very early childhood make friends with words, because that's what the world is made of these days, is information, and they have to be able to understand it, process it, spit it back out. And from, you know, age 3 months, there's nothing that can help them on that path more than books.
Absolutely. I mean, if you forget everything else that happens in school, the ability to, it's not just the reading and the writing, it's the empathy that you gain only from reading, the ability to put yourself in other shoes, to see possible consequences for actions that you don't have to take or mistakes you don't have to make. If we did nothing else with our kids but just sat them in schools and had them read all day long, I don't know if we'd see a whole lot worse. Maybe we wouldn't see it better, but we certainly wouldn't see it worse.
I feel like that was kind of how I got through school, was sitting in the back of the classroom reading something else.
Yes, and again, too often, I don't want to get on my little soapbox here, but I think we have set these specific academic standards that everybody must achieve, even though some people say, you know, I'd rather be reading than solving for X. And there's a certain point we need to be able to respect that and let them read or solve for X.
I really like the way you put that, because I think of reading as practice for life. That's what you do when you read books. And oh my gosh, life is a big pain. And we all need all the practice we can get. And books, especially books for young people, are a safe place to practice.
Before we get into that cliched question of what got you into writing, let's start with what got you into reading. What do you remember early on having been moved by?
I think the question is different for people of a certain age than it is now, because I grew up before digital entertainment. So, you know, there was some television, but really my main choice of entertainment, if I wasn't playing outside, was books. And as an immigrant, my father was just floored by the American Public Library. Never seen anything like it. It's a miracle. It's just, you walk in, you get an armful of books, you walk out, and you don't pay a cent. I mean, that it's like it shouldn't work, right? But it does work, and it's amazing. I mean, I know that Ken Burns has called the national parks America's greatest idea, but I got to put public libraries right up there with them, and that's how I became a reader, is just regular trips to the public library.
I noticed in the acknowledgments of your latest book, you mentioned that you wrote most of it right around the corner from me at the Brighton Memorial Library.
That's right.
Charles, what about you?
I was very fortunate. I grew up in a house that was surrounded by books, and there may be a bunch of reasons, but my dad was a builder at the time, so it was a track house in Greece, but he was on the team that built the house, and he did the finishing inside, and he put a lot of bookshelves in, so the house was filled with books. I've always wondered, did he fill the house with books because he wanted the books, or because, well, now I got these bookshelves, I got to put something on them. But in any case, there was bookshelves in virtually every room, and that's one thing you could always get in my family. You may not be able to get the latest toy. I got those too, but my sisters didn't, but I did. But you could always get a book. You could always get a ride to the library. And I grew up in a family of voracious readers. I'm very thankful for that.
What books stick out to you? What do you remember?
Not necessarily because it was any good, but I was there was a phase in my life where probably from about sixth grade till about 11th grade or so, where for me it had to have a guy with bulging muscles and a sword and a woman in a silver metal bikini and, you know, and some strange planet name with dragons and things like that. It had to have that, or I really didn't find myself pulled towards it. And I read the John Carter of Mars series when I was in 7th and 8th grade, and I went back, and these are a series of fantasy novels that were written in the early 20th century, and it's definitely written in late Edwardian prose. It's thick and it's dense, and the action is snail's pace, but some reason I got hooked on these, and I went back and tried to read them a few years ago. I couldn't get through chapter 2 of the first book that I know I read a dozen times, but it's not because they whetted the machine. They primed the machine, and it got me anxious to read anything, any adventure, a story from somebody else's point of view that I could just get in there. So it wasn't so much because they were great books, but they were great at getting me going.
Linda Sue?
Yeah, I agree. I read all over the map, everything from, you know, the Nancy Drew series and Trixie Belden is another one that I remember, to what's considered the classics of children's literature. I read a lot of nonfiction. There was a nonfiction biography series that I remember from the school library that I'm sure was riddled with errors, but I read them all anyway. And I don't know, I guess I feel pretty strongly that kids should be able to read anything they're interested in, and there's a lot of worry from parents and educators about, you know, reading at an appropriate level and all that, and I just find that for the most part, if it's not appropriate, kids put it down, because they're not interested. Let them read whatever it is they want, especially summer reading. You know, read for pleasure, no tests, no assignments. If they want to read it, let them read it. Everything counts. Graphic novels count, comic books count, picture books that are quote-unquote too young for you, it all counts.
Right, and I have to give a special shout-out. There was a manager at the Walden bookstore over in Greece, long closed, but he went on to another career with other booksellers as well. He must have only been like maybe 15 years older than me, but as a kid I'd go in there and he didn't tell you what sections you could go to. And so when I remember distinctly in seventh grade, I bought this super thick book on the Hindenburg disaster. I thought it had to be 2 inches thick, and I didn't have enough money. I was like 50 cents short, and he said, "Well, I'll cover you this time." and he asked me every time I went in, "How's that book going?" And you're right. So why was I reading a book on the Hindenburg as a seventh grader in the summer? I couldn't afford. And yet, here was another adult encouraging me to just follow whatever you found interesting in.
Yeah. Is there, you know, Linda, so you mentioned that the difference between our generation and our kids' generation. Is it still possible to have that kind of engagement with literature when there's a screen in front of your face 24/7?
Oh, I think absolutely. And not only that it's possible, but that it's essential. And there's a lot of brain research these days that shows that reading is actually an incredibly complex skill, and it reaches layers and parts of our brains that nothing else do. Part of my school visits is I tell the kids that they're the first generation to have grown up all digital. And if the whole world goes all digital all the time, the human race is going to get stupider because the inner layers of the brain and parts of the brain are not going to be reached. So it is their job, along with all the digital fun that they can have in the entertainment, it is their job to stop the stupid. And they do by reading. And that, once again, goes back to liking reading, preferably loving reading, which means letting them read what they want to. So the aim, especially of summer reading to me, is to cultivate a love of reading, which you don't do by, no, don't read that, you should read this. That's never going to cultivate a love of reading. I'm not saying don't prompt them. You know, I mean, offer them all kinds of choices. Maybe books that they wouldn't have picked up themselves. That's fine. You never know when they're going to find something. But when they do find something, whatever it is that they love, even a 2-inch thick book about the Hindenburg, let them read it.
I couldn't agree more in that we try to tell them what to do. And unfortunately, our school curriculums, I think, do a wonderful job of beating the love out of reading for most kids. When I talk with younger kids, I don't write for younger kids right now. I shouldn't say that. My characters aren't of interest yet to younger readers. when I talk to them, they love reading, and they're always bringing the books over. By the time I get to the high school students, they've been so force-fed the things that they have to read. And there's nothing wrong with the books they have to read, but, man, if it's just you're not ready for it and that's not what you want to read, nothing will beat the love out of you of something that you could really learn to like. But there's just something about forcing required curriculums of books that don't really appeal to them. I know there's a sense of we have to have this shared, you know, cultural landscape where we've all read similar books and things like that. But
hasn't it ever been thus, though? I mean, I remember slogging through the assigned reading lists when I was in middle school and high school.
Well, I remember faking my way through the assigned reading list and reading what I wanted to read. But you're right. I think it is a problem. But instead of just simply going, well, that's the way it goes, so I think we really need to be more proactive and think, well, what will get people reading? If our agreed goal is a nation of readers of fiction and nonfiction, not just light reading, but can get into and understand the depth of things and get beyond a surface and look for meaning, then if that's our goal, is the current system of requiring everybody to read certain books the best way to get there? And I just think it's a good debate.
Yes, but I actually think that things have changed. I mean, if you talk to teachers, I mean, Charles, you were a teacher for a long time. Current emphasis on standards has given teachers nightmares schedule-wise, and
right.
They do have less freedom. They have a lot less freedom to do what they used to do. In fifth grade, I have never forgotten my teacher reading aloud to us every single day at the end of the day. And it was a big carrot. She's like, I am not reading aloud to you guys if you don't get X or Y done. And even the so-called bad kids in the class would fall into line because we so wanted that story read to us. There is a lot less time for that these days. But I do have to give a shout out to no matter what your system is, your standardization, your curriculum, your requirements, there are always incredibly heroic teachers and librarians who understand that the emphasis on reading for pleasure is so important, and they somehow do it. It is way more work for them. It is way more work to find a book for each child than to simply yank one off the curriculum shelf and read it to all of them. It is way more work, and yet there are teachers and librarians who do it all the time. So a big shout out to them, and thank you so much for that work you do.
Yeah, it does make a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely, and you can tell who the good ones are, and you're absolutely right. I agree with you. It is harder and harder to find the room to do that and to be adaptable. So let's turn to your new books. I wouldn't want to let you out of here without a chance to promote some new books and to promote some good reading. Linda, so I want to start with you because it's fascinating to me. You're one of those rare writers who's working on two different tracks. You're writing not only for teenagers and young adults, but you're also doing picture books for younger children. And the new picture book is called Yak's Yak, Animal Word Pairs, and I love the concept of this. Explain the concept of this.
Well, this came about, there's actually a real Northwest New York State connection here. A friend of mine, a really wonderful writer named M.T. Anderson, was visiting here and said to me, Linda Sue, listen to this.
Buffalo,
this
buffalo.
Is actually a sentence,
yep.
Right. Buffalo, 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 buffalo. I had never heard it. I thought it was the coolest thing ever. It stayed in my mind. And I would say it to people occasionally.
And we should explain this for people who are saying, why are these people repeating buffalo over and over again?
Right. That's actually five buffaloes in a row is a completely grammatical English sentence.
Yeah, it's on Wikipedia.
Okay, yeah.
I'm trying to get through it and figure it. I got to say, it's not so easy.
Right.
You really have to, wait a minute. Is it the buffalo? It takes you a while, but it's worth the effort.
It is fun, yeah. Buffalo, who are from Buffalo, bully, other buffalo who are from Buffalo. So that's the short version. It goes longer, but the short version most people can get their minds around. I never forgot that. And eventually, these things, you know, sort of simmer around in my subconscious or whatever. And I one day asked myself, what other animals are like that? What other animals are also verbs? And the first one that came to mind was Yak's Yak, which became the title of the book right then and there and stayed there forever, which is unusual for me because I have trouble with titles and often change them. And I went through and made a list, and I eliminated any that needed an extra word. I wanted an exact, you know, yaks, yak, bats, bat, fish, fish. So several that got eliminated would be like chickens, chicken out, monkeys, monkey around. Anything that needed an adverb, I got rid of. And so the result is 18 pairs of words with wonderful illustrations by Jennifer Black Reinhardt that really elevate the book, I think.
I have to tell you, this turned out to be a big favorite in my house with both the second grader and the seventh grader. She loved it too because they're both into wordplay. And I've mentioned buffalo, 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 buffalo to my daughter, and she gets it. My son's kind of still trying to wrap his head around that one. What's it like with books like this? I mean, obviously, you know, if you were getting paid by the word, you would never do these. Because even with the explanations in here, you know, so for duck ducks, it's to duck is to crouch or to dive. What's the process like of trying to put a book like this together where you know that so much of it is going to rest not in your hands, but with your illustrator that you're collaborating with?
Most of my picture books have been born out of my love of poetry. I wrote poetry as a young person, and I'm always encouraging young people to write poetry because sometimes you meet, especially there seems to be a young man between the ages of about 9 to 13 who's always writing a fantasy novel with a girl in a silver bikini like the one you were talking
about.
Don't
forget
right,
the sword.
Right. And I'm like, okay, novels are hard, and I'm sure there are any hundreds of these that have been abandoned. But poetry you can finish, and you can tell a story in a poem. So picture books came out of my love for poetry. I didn't start writing longer form fiction until I was almost 40. So it was years and years of writing poetry, and that's where the picture books come from. Part of poetry, a big part of poetry, is wordplay. So Yak's Yak is not my only wordplay book. And I am very conscious of the fact that I am turning in a manuscript that is 37 words long and that the illustrator is going to really carry the burden. And I so appreciate that. And authors will have heated discussions about this. They're called picture books. They're not called word books with pictures. So I think it perfectly fitting that the illustrator in books like this one should get top billing.
I just want to say something out as to anybody sitting here thinking, I'm going to write a picture book, 36 words. I've written novels for adults. I write novels for young adults. As you move farther down the reading level, I don't say reading level, we move down the target audience, for lack of a better word right now, the writing gets harder and harder. I found writing mystery novels easier than writing the young adult novels that I've been writing. I've just finished a book that was aimed at middle grades, and I found that harder. And I've attempted to do picture books, much as I've attempted to do poetry, and both of them ended up in not places that are shareable. So they're just not really. It's far harder than it sounds to say something fun and meaningful, carry a story, keep people's interest with the fewer words. It gets harder and harder.
I think that's why you get celebrities writing picture books, because it looks like it's easier. But I really appreciate your saying that, Charles. And Mark Twain once wrote to a friend, "I would have written you a shorter letter, but I didn't have time." Shorter is harder.
Yeah.
There is some truth to that. So we've got Yak's Yak, and there's an interesting little connection because, of course, I'm looking at the Bat's Bat page here, and that ties into Wing and Claw, Forest of Wonders, which is the first part of a trilogy, and the star character of this, I think you'd agree, is this amazing, funny, talking bat named Echo.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the genesis. It's this neat story of a, 12 years old?
Yes.
12-year-old kid growing up in a forest, learning how to be an apothecary and how to create potions, and gets pulled into this big adventure involving talking animals and new friends that he meets. Where did the idea for this come from?
Well, I don't know if Charles feels the same way, but it's always difficult to answer that question because there's so many strands that go into a book. And it's very rare that I have this eureka light bulb moment that's the idea for a book. It's much murkier and more tangled than that. But a few of the threads. I've always been interested in the relationship between what we eat and our culture and our health and our bodies throughout history. My historical fiction is all full of food because, you know, food is an incredible universal, right? So apothecary, which is making medicine from herbs and berries and things like that, is very closely related. So that was one sort of thread that I was really interested in and wanted to explore. But the fact that it's a fantasy, I loved reading fantasy. I still love reading fantasy. And yet, I often have problems with fantasy because the magic is inconsistent. So if you think about, for example, an example that I hope a lot of people will understand, the last book in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, they struggle with this ring, okay? They make this horrible journey. They finally achieve their mission, and they're exhausted and nearly half dead. And an eagle comes along to carry them back to where they need to go. Where was the eagle 3 pages earlier, right? I mean, and there's no explanation for why it shows up, you know. And those sorts of moments, and they exist in nearly every fantasy, I can forgive because I'm with the characters, the writing is strong, it's really cool. But when I wrote a fantasy, when I decided to write a fantasy, I'm like, I am not going to have those inconsistencies. So there are certain plants that if a skilled apothecary combines them and makes them in the right way, has magical effects on only animals. So this means there's no, oh, why doesn't he just whip out his wand here? Mm-hmm. Okay, there's none of that. There's very specific circumstances that the magic takes place. I hope it's still magical enough for fantasy fans because, quite frankly, it is something the editor asked me about. She said, when kids read fantasy, they want lots of magic. And I'm like, I promise to do my best that they'll still like this, even though the magic, as one reviewer said, is doled out with an eyedropper. But that is why Echo's role gets beefed up and he becomes a real star in the story because, you know, who doesn't love a talking animal?
And you even introduce the eyedropper in there. Just
I do.
And think about it. Where do you put an eyedropper? You put it in your eye, so you're getting it right to where it needs to go.
Right.
It's Connections, Summer Book Week, our final hour of Summer Book Week. We will continue in just a moment after a quick break with Linda Sue Park and Charles Benoit here on WXXI, WRUR, and WEOS. On Monday's Connections, Evan Dawson is back. In the first hour, Congressman Anthony Weiner was all over the headlines. Now he's on movie screens as the star of the new documentary, Weiner. It's playing at the Little. Evan will be talking about it in the first hour. And then in our second hour, help for elderly veterans. All ahead on Connections, Monday from WXXI, WRUR, and WEOS. And welcome back to Connections with Evan Dawson. Evan will be back next Monday. We'll get back into the real world of politics and all that other stuff. But for right now, I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan on the final hour of Summer Book Week. And in this pre-recorded hour, we are talking about the wonderful world of literature for children. And we're talking about fantasy at the moment right now with Linda Sue Park, who is the Newbery Medal winning author of a number of books, including her latest, Wing and Claw, Forest of Wonders. Now, this is the beginning of a trilogy, and I know as the parent of a nearly teenage daughter that it's all about the series. And I guess that's not really a new thing, thinking back to the Nancy Drews and all of that. What is the magic with children's literature of series? Why does it seem to matter so much to have part of a series, both for the reader and then I guess also to an extent for the author, too?
The same but different. I love adult mystery series. I mean, and I have to read them in order. But you get to know a character and they get to be like a friend. And then there's another book where you get to spend more time with your friend, somebody you really like and who does exciting things that you can go along with them and practice, as we said before, at life. And so this is my first time that I've written a trilogy. I've written two books in a series, but that was kind of an interesting aberration because it was a series called The 39 Clues. The first series was 10 books written by 10 different authors. So I was part of a series and yet not. So this is the first time I've written a series on my own, and it's been a blast writing books 2 and 3, knowing the character so well and not having to do that building work. Wow, that was really fun. So I've just finished up book 3, and I'm writing book 2, which is out next March 2017, and I'm getting started on book 3.
I've noticed in flipping through some of my daughter's books this thing that publishers do now where you get to the end of book 1 and you think you're done, and then lo and behold, oh look, there's the first chapter of book 2 right in there, bound into the book, waiting for you.
Yes.
Is there pressure now from publishers to try to create something that can be, if not necessarily, I mean, nothing can be the next Harry Potter, but that will keep readers hooked on this?
Well, yes, you definitely do want them to finish book one and be just, you know, champing at the bit for book two. I mean, that would be the goal with a series. And there's all kinds of ways to do it. Yeah, I think there's pressure. There's more pressure than there used to be. Publishers used to be able to kind of nurse a promising writer along, and now they want the good sales figures right out of the gate. So there's any number of ways to do that with, especially internet presence is big with young people. But sometimes it's a function of what's called the signature, the way the book is printed. So there were many blank pages at the end of this book when it was printed, and they were thinking of a way to not make it look so empty at the back, and asked me how I would feel about putting in the first chapter of book two. So that's how we solved that problem.
Was it already written at that point, or did you?
It got written quickly.
I have to say that you said series is, it's all about the series. Yes, that's been my big career mistake. I never wrote a mystery series. I haven't done a young adult series. The new book I just finished isn't a series. I think if I could give any warning advice to anybody out there, if you're looking to make a long-lasting career, think longer term. I was always thinking I love the freedom that comes with standalones, and that you start one of my books and there isn't another one. So I'm free to do whatever I want to any of the characters any way that I want. And while that brings a lot of freedom, one of the top questions I get asked when I talk at schools is there going to be a sequel? And when I say, how can there be? No, there's no sequel. Well, you could do this. It's like, I know, I've moved on. And so I would have to say, from a career standpoint, I wish I had what it takes to write a series. And I also know myself as a writer. I just don't think I would have the staying power. I don't think I could maintain the story arc for the length of time that you'd need. It's a different approach to writing.
Actually, I totally agree, Charles. I love the freedom of the standalone. And the fact that this is a trilogy, it's not actually a series, if you see what I mean. And I thought of it as one giant book that it was going to be divided up into three. Because I don't think I have the right mentality to produce a long-running series either.
But you've literally created a world here. It's called Obsidia. It's got the river down the middle of it, and the forest on one side, and the city on the other. And as you mentioned in the at the end of it, every good fantasy novel has to have the map at the beginning showing showing the land. So you've obviously you're creating a deeper world than you would necessarily for a single book, right?
Yeah, I guess that's an interesting question. I mean, for most of my books, I at least have a map in my head. But that the trope of the map at the beginning of a fantasy novel, just you have to have it.
Yeah.
You know, so. But do notice that because I'm such a library kid, that the map is not on the end papers at my request.
Right. So
because if you're a library
over,
kid, it gets taped down and you can't see the whole thing.
I can't tell you how many books I carefully have lifted up the tape from and put it back before it goes back to the library.
Right.
Absolutely. I want to ask about the characters who are in here, because besides the talking animals, there are human characters, and your protagonists for much of this, in addition to your lead protagonist, who's a boy, there are two girls who are with him. Is that something that comes from you? Is that something that comes from the marketplace these days? Is there more of a sense that you have to have more female characters and more diverse characters now?
Well, diversity is sort of one of my things, so I'm always conscious of that. I love middle grade because you can have boys and girls together without having to do the romance thing, you know. I'm interested in writing YA someday with the romance thing, but for middle grade, you can have boy and girl friendships. I think that's just was part of my world growing up, and that's why in most of my books, I would say there, whenever the main character is of one gender, there are very strong supporting characters of the other. And it's interesting. I guess I don't think of it as a marketing ploy. I think of it as sort of, you know, my past childhood of having friends of both genders. That's what I want to reflect in my books. Yeah, and then these girls, they kick butt.
Yes, they do. The literary world around you, do you see it changing in that same way? Is there more now, you know, if you're a girl looking for something to read, if you're Asian and looking for something to read that reflects you?
Yes, slowly. It's changing slowly. And certainly over the past couple of years, with the We Need Diverse Books movement and other awarenesses that have been propagated online, there is definitely at least more awareness, and that's where it starts. And the job is not just changing children's books or publishing. It's actually changing the culture. So it's a long game. It's a long game, and it's not going to happen overnight. But I think the increased awareness in publishing houses for young people is a really, really good thing.
It is Connections with Evan Dawson. I'm not Evan Dawson. I'm Scott Feibusch. In with you for the final hour of Summer Book Week. Evan will be back on Monday. And for this final hour, we are talking about books for children and young adults and adults who would like to read some of this too. And so we kind of turn over to the other end of the table here. And Charles Benoit, your new book is called Snow Job.
Right.
And this is, as young adult literature goes, this is a pretty darn adult book.
Yeah, see, that's one of the things that I always like to make sure I point out is that I don't write young adult books. I write books with young adult protagonists. And sometimes they're going to appeal to adult readers and sometimes they're going to appeal to young adults. But that is definitely one of the things I came in here is I wanted to write a noir novel set in Rochester in 1978. Not any deep nostalgia, but only I just needed parents who are not as good as today's parents. I needed technology. I just wanted to tell an old-fashioned noir story with a teen protagonist. And you're right. It is. When some parents will ask me, you know, like, well, my son's going into seventh grade. Is this a good book for him? It's like, well, eventually, but not really. Maybe not right now. Just considering the story plot line involves a kid who's trying to turn his life around by just coming up with a simple list of things that will just help him. Four things that's going to turn his life around. Because he's a high school senior. He knows he's not going to graduate. It's too late. He can't go back and save any of that. But he can save the rest of his life by just coming up with a short list of things to do to change his life. And so he sets out, follows his list, and 2 weeks later he's moving large amounts of cocaine for a Rochester-based drug dealer and plotting with the drug dealer's possibly prostitute girlfriend to rip off said dealer and ignore a murder that may or may not have happened. Yeah, so, you know, something for everybody.
We've clearly moved past the point where the boys and the girls are just playing together without anything ulterior going on. We've got what may or may not be the Gates Motel in there.
Well, there's a lot of, if you're a local reader, you'll see a lot of references, but it's interesting because I did a recent talk about this book downstate, and people there said, oh my God, it's set right here. It's, yeah, it is. but there's a lot of references to, they go out to Tahoe's. I couldn't call it Nick Tahoe's because the character's name is Nick. It's like, oh, bad planning. But yeah, if you're familiar with the area and if you grew up in this place in the 1970s, a lot of this will ring very familiar to you. But hopefully it's written in a way that no matter where you grew up or when you grew up, a lot of it will ring familiar to you.
I want to ask about that local piece of it because we've had a number of authors through over the course of the week who have little bits here and there maybe of local flavor. And this clearly, for somebody who's from here, you know, they're driving up in the snow to get to Watertown and they get caught in a storm in Oswego and there's Genesee Street and there's, you know, whatever happens late at night on Lyle Avenue.
Right.
It's a very Rochester book. Does that help you locally, or is it just kind of something that you do for fun?
For local sales? I wish it was so easy. No, I don't even think it's helped sales within my family. I think it just helps me get a better idea where things are taking place. That map that you have at the beginning of your book, well, I was able to start this one with a mental map. But the truth is almost every young adult book I've written has been based in Greece, where I grew up, you just wouldn't know it. I know it because I know where the characters are walking. I know what they're doing. This one here, I did deliberately put a few more breadcrumbs in because so many people said they enjoyed that kind of thing. Whether it will help sales or not, I don't think it makes any difference at all. But it did help me to better visualize it when I was writing it. So I just thought I'd share what was already going on in my head.
You mentioned setting it in the late 1970s in parts so that you could have parents who are off
right.
doing their own thing
right.
and not deeply involved with the kids. I wanted to ask you about that milieu because I was thinking about my daughter reading this book, which she did, and I was thinking that, you know, probably some of the most alien parts to her were just this whole idea of, you know, late 1970s and somebody driving around in a rusty Ford Pinto with an 8-track player. And that's got to be in some ways almost as exotic to them now
as the forests of Obsidia in Linda Sue's book, right?
That's a good point. I have heard from a lot of kids who had heard of these things, like, and I do specifically mention like the Ramones and the Runaways and very specific things like their touchstones that hopefully they're going to go back and look up and see what they were. But you're right about the one of the biggest things is the relationship with parents. Because so many kids who've read the book have told me, why didn't he just explain to his parents? It's like, ah, oh, that's so great that you can. And it's wonderful. But and I'm not, I had great parents. They loved me dearly. I had a great childhood. But the fact is that on a Friday night when I was a high school senior, I could say to my mom, I'm going out. And she'd say, where are you going? I'm going to Rick's. When are you going to be home? Sunday. Okay. So I just... You know, or one of the favorite lines that she used to say when I'd leave the house, don't get caught. So it's like, oh, great.
Well, here you have your protagonist, Nick, is closing up a convenience store at midnight and then walking home 4 miles, and he may or may not show up. And I'm thinking, my kid is probably never going to have
that
experience.
I had that, too.
I worked on Jefferson Road at a gas station when I was that age.
Right, and I used to routinely hitchhike home. It's the convenience store I worked at, and I conveniently hitchhiked home, which was a good 4 miles. So it's there's a lot of similarity, but you're right. It's an alien world.
There's that great scene where the woman who may or may not be the prostitute, may or may not become Nick's girlfriend, at least for a while. The first way they meet is she walks in and she's playing the change scam with him when he's behind the counter of, oh, wait, all I got is a 20. And then somehow she ends up $10 ahead. And I'm thinking, yeah, somebody did that to me. I learned the hard way about that.
That's exactly how it happened.
When I was working the counter. Did that happen to you,
too?
Yeah,
exactly. When I was working at the convenience store, you came in, and it wasn't a attractive Joan Jett lookalike. It was just some guy who quickly said, oh, yeah, give me enough ones. Well, let me just switch this back. And I just went through it, and then, of course, that night the drawer was $10 short. And when I wrote that scene in there, I had to go back and practice it so many times to make sure I got it right. Even my editor, Ann Hoppe, wrote to me and said, are you sure that works? Because I'm not following it. And so I did get the money, play it out hand by hand, just see it really does work.
I can attest to the veracity of that scene. I'll back you up on that one.
So, kids, if you're looking for a way to shortchange a clerk.
And the guys who came in with long trench coats in the middle of summer and just stood in front of the racks of cigarettes for a while and walked out. A very real thing. Is this a tough sell to a publisher?
It wasn't for me. My publisher's been very clear that I can write wherever direction I want to go. If she thinks it's a good story, if it's got a compelling story, the drugs and the violence and that kind of stuff that's related into it, that's not what the book's about. The book's about, can this kid turn his life around? To what extent are you capable of reinventing yourself? What does it mean to be a good person? And what does it mean to follow through on things? It really doesn't have anything to do with the drug. That's just a vehicle to get there. And my editor is very understanding. As long as I've got something bigger planned than just this adventure around drugs, she would never stand for that. It has to have depth.
I'll tell you, when we did the Young Adult Day on last year's Summer Book Week, and, of course, my daughter Ari, who was 11 at that point, was in here with us and asking questions, and she took Snow Job off to summer camp with her and was reading it, and I mentioned to her before we did the show that you were going to be on again. She said, oh, can I tell him that I wasn't really wild about the ending? I said, yeah. She said, it was very dark. I said, yeah, it kind of was, wasn't it? And it's interesting that her reaction wasn't, oh, they were talking about drugs and there was sex in there. There was none of that. It was just that ending really wasn't a happy ending, was it?
It's a realistic ending.
Yeah. And I think perhaps as she gets past 12 that she'll get more of that. We are in our final minutes now of Summer Book Week on Connections from WXXI, WRUR, and WEOS, talking with Charles Benoit, the author most recently of Snow Job, and Linda Sue Park, the author of Wing and Claw, Forest of Wonders, and Yak's Yak, among many others. I want to talk about promoting these books and about getting them out there and what has become now this, you know, as I keep putting it when I'm trying to figure out what to do during these shows each summer, you know, it's a fire hose of potential material that you can drink from. How do you get noticed in this world where there is just so much, you know, my daughter is coming home constantly with all of these new series. Like, how do you even keep track of all of this?
Oh, it's not possible.
You don't know how glad I am to hear you say that. Yeah. What am I doing wrong?
Right. No. I think that's the question we all of us try to answer every single day. And it's really pretty awful because most of us are writers because we want to write and we're non-marketers. Well, Charles was an ad man, I guess. But most of us don't know how to. I don't have a clue how to do it. I rely on my publisher. I rely on word of mouth. And the internet has been great for that. Mostly you just, you know, what I do when I'm sitting down at my computer each day, I'm not thinking, how am I going to market this book? I'm thinking, how can I write the best story I can possibly write? And then you just have to hope that best effort finds its readership.
You're absolutely right. I have to trust my editors. And one of the problems I have is I don't write the kind of books that teens usually buy themselves. They're standalone. They tend to be darker. And they don't have the happy endings. Not all of them, I shouldn't say that. They have endings that are satisfying in a different way. Kids aren't lining up to buy my books. They're being bought by libraries, librarians, teachers. So it's a different marketing tool. My editor is always telling me that they know how to reach what she calls the gatekeepers, and that's where they put their marketing efforts. Months before the book is ever published, they've already got the gates primed, or they've got where they know where they're going. As far as reaching general public, you got me on that one. And I work in advertising.
I know you've done video trailers.
Yep. I don't know to any extent that does anything but make me feel good about doing a video trailer. I had to think if I ever bought a book because I saw a video about it. I bought a book because something about the cover pulled me in, something about the inside front flap, or word of mouth. I just had a book passed on to me by a colleague, and she said, I don't care what you're reading. Drop what you're reading. You got to read this. So that gets cut through a lot faster than a video trailer.
My best-selling book, which many of your listeners will, I hope, be familiar with, is A Long Walk to Water, which is a story of a Sudanese refugee who was local here to Rochester. And that I'm very, very stunned and delighted to say has sold more than 1 million copies. Wow. And that was totally something that was out of my control. It was a librarian here in Western New York who noticed the book and was on the curriculum committee when they were redoing the seventh grade curriculum. And she took it to the committee and said, I want this on the curriculum. And it's one of those I'm just so incredibly honored and delighted because it is one of those required reading books that kids are loving. I mean, I get letters from the most reluctant of readers saying, I love this book. And there's just nothing that makes you feel better than that when your book, you know, reaches a reluctant reader. But that's not something I did. It's something that someone else did, right? For my book, which is absolutely incredible. And I go back to the fact that the reason that she fought so hard to do this and that's resulted in the incredible sales is because I sat there trying to write the best book I could possibly write.
Right. That's always the best advice whenever I give people say, well, how do you become a best-selling author? It's like, obviously, I don't know. But it starts by writing the best book you possibly can write. And that's the only advice I can ever give anybody. Just they always say, well, it's not quite done yet. It's not, well, then don't show it to anybody. Make it the best book you can write.
I'm guessing if you could get J.K. Rowling in here, if she's listening, we'd love to have you in here for next year. That would be fun. I'm guessing she'd probably say the same thing, that Harry Potter wasn't something, it caught fire independently of what she did, aside from having written a, you know, really riveting series of books. But Charles, I read through some of your books, and especially Snow Job, and I'm thinking this could be one of those independent films that, you know, we might show at the Little someday.
Oh, your lips to but that's
it's got a cinematic feel to it. Has there ever been any interest? Have you ever thought
The only book that was some interest in was my first mystery that ever came out, the one that was nominated for the Edgar called Relative Danger. And the only problem with that they determined was that it takes place in Toronto, Pottsville, Pennsylvania, Morocco, Egypt, Bahrain, and Singapore. So they said, yeah, it's too small of a novel for that big of a shoot. But man, if somebody's interested in making Snow Job into a movie, contact my editor. As you know, we have no control over these things. You know, it's all somebody else's. Boy, I would love that.
Even if they do a horrible job, I love it.
I was going to say, when you got to Toronto, like, everything's shot in Toronto. That's easy. And then that gets a little more complicated past there. Have you ever had interest in...
The Newbery Medal book, A Single Shard, has been turned into a play, theatrical production several times, and that's always been such a thrill, so interesting. There is a company who has optioned A Long Walk to Water, which is a long way from it becoming a film. Who wouldn't? There's some people who wouldn't, but, you know, I'd love to see what people would do with it. It's always interesting to see how your work gets interpreted.
I want to see the CGI version of Echo the Talking Bat. I think that would be.
I would love that too.
That would be fun. You mentioned, Linda Sue, about getting letters from readers. You still get letters from readers?
Oh yes.
That's good to hear. That's heartening. Charles, do you?
Threats and letters, yeah. mine are mostly come around to your book ending. I didn't like it. Why did you end it this way? Can you please explain it? And I always tend to write back, like, you figure it out. You know, you got a better idea than me. And so mostly the kind of letters I get are those kind of dealing around with dude, that bothers me that it went that way.
Do they come as actual paper letters or do they come in emails?
I haven't gotten a paper letter.
But that's a deliberate strategy on my part because I can't handle digital correspondence. I get too much of it, which is what happens if you do middle grade and if you do, on my website, it specifies that it has to be a paper letter. And at school visits, I have to explain. You write a letter, and then there's this thing called an envelope with a stamp. So I do write back to every single person who writes to me, which I would not be able to do if it was digital.
I've been working with a teacher from Normal, Illinois. She has written to me last couple of years where all of her students have written me letters. And she works with students that that are having some developmental disability issues to get through, and they've taken my first young adult book, You, and they write their opinions on it, and they illustrate some things with me. And so she's been sending that to me every year. I write back to every single kid and send them a copy of another book. Her classes are getting bigger.
The book's all coming out of pocket for you, too?
Oh, yeah. I mean, at this point in my career, I don't think they're going to be making movies, but I would like to have more readers. So I'm doing whatever I can to get more people reading my books, because that, in the end, is all that really matters.
Mine get a bookmark. I write to hundreds of readers every year. So.
Yeah, you're getting a lot more people writing to you.
With the picture books?
We're switching to bookmarks, people.
There you go.
Just letting you know.
With the picture books, I imagine that's a whole different kind of audience reaction that you get for those.
It is. And for the picture books, I usually get pictures. They'll draw something, you know, the younger, say, grade two and younger, if they write to me, they sometimes do write a letter, but they often draw a picture of whatever it is they liked in the picture book. So I get letters from them, too. It's wonderful.
Well, that's fantastic. Are there still school visits? Do you still get to go in and read to kids?
Yep. I'm doing less of them just because of personal circumstances. I now look after my grandchildren, so it's harder for me to do school visits. But they were, for a very long time, a very rewarding part of my career. It's something that people, that Charles will know, that people who write for adults don't understand, our relationship with our fans. I mean, even if you think back right now to a book that you loved when you were a child, you still remember it 30, 40, 50 years later. And a lot of adults can't remember what they read last year. Those are the books we get to write. Those are the fans we get to have. You know, I mean, nobody loves a book the way they do when they're a kid. And there's just nothing better, you know, to have somebody say, oh my gosh, I loved your book. We get to hear that so much more often than people who write for adults.
That's
Ari has her dream list of authors that she'd love me to get in for this segment. Rick Riordan is right up there.
Oh, yeah.
We tried. He wasn't available this time, but I told her we at least gave it a shot. We are talking with Linda Sue Park, author of Yak's Yak and Wing and Claw, among others. Charles Benoit, author of Snow Job. What's next on the agenda for both of you?
Well, as I said, there will be books 2 and 3 of the trilogy coming out. And far down the line, I'm very excited about another picture book that's going to be illustrated by Jennifer Black Reinhart. It's called Gondra's Treasure. It's about a little girl dragon. Both Eastern and Western mythology have dragons. In the West, dragons breathe fire and hoard treasure and live in caves. In the East, in Asian mythology, they breathe mist and they live in water, in rivers and lakes. So this little girl has a father from the east and a mother from the west. She breathes fire out of one nostril and mist out of the other. So it's about being a mixed race family, basically.
Charles?
Yeah. Up next, I wrote a middle grades book about a kid that gets to spend a week in Montana with a very crazy great aunt and some of the strange adventures that involved there. The opening line for that is, I'll never forget the morning my great aunt Helen Louise shot me. Ooh. So, and nice. It's a lighthearted comedy nice. Adventure. So
excellent. You can see so much more about Linda Sue Park and Charles Benoit and all of our Summer Book Week authors at our website, WXXINews.org. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. Thank you so much to everybody who's helped out for this week, including our producer, Megan Mack, Lisa Feibusch, who helped produce and engineer this hour's segment. We will be back with Evan Dawson on Monday. Thanks for being with us for Summer Book Week on Connections.